This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Salim Yacoub is a historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He specializes in U.S. involvement in the Middle East. His latest book is Imperfect Strangers, Americans, Arabs, and U.S. Middle East Relations in the 1970s. He spoke with my colleague, Joshua Landis.
Salim Yacoub, welcome to Norman campus of University of Oklahoma.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you've written on the Eisenhower Doctrine, 1970s U.S.-Arab relations. Are there similarities between the 1950s, the beginnings of the Cold War, and what you see in the Middle East today?
I would say in a very broad sense, there's a similarity in that you have this region that is seen as vital to U.S. security and prosperity that is in a state of turmoil. And there's concern about the geopolitical orientation of the region, about forces that are perceived to be anti-U.S., extremist, hostile, so forth, gaining ascendancy in the region. So in that very general sense, there is a similarity. But
in the 50s, of course, it was Nasserism and secular Arab nationalism
right. That
was spreading. Eisenhower Doctrine promulgated in order to save Lebanon from going to Nasserist Arab nationalists,
right. From
the Christian Maronite Lebanese that were very much pro-Western.
Right.
What today, Lebanon is in the hands of Hezbollah, right? And Iran, the tentacles of a malevolent Iran, as it's described
in
U.S. news, are spreading through Shiite Iraq, of course, maintaining an Assad regime. And the United States has been supporting Sunni rebels in Syria to overthrow the Assad regime, which is theoretically pro-Iranian, and to keep out Russian influence. Is the United States abandoning the northern Middle East, or are we fighting in order to keep it in some kind of American sphere of influence?
Now, when you say the northern Middle East, what are you referring to?
Lebanon, Syria, Iraq.
Well, it's hard to say what the United States is doing right now, because I think the new administration has not articulated its foreign policy clearly in a whole number of areas. So it's very difficult for me to say exactly what's taking place right now. I mean, I think until recently, which is to say during the Obama administration, there was a real ambivalence and sense of uncertainty about how to move. And certainly wanting to see the Assad regime in Syria removed from power, but also fearing the consequences of a vacuum in Syria that would allow ISIS to spread even further. And you know, the dithering over whether to support the elements of the Syrian opposition and all that, you know, the red line that was not enforced. You can argue that particular episode both ways. I tend to be more sympathetic to the Obama administration than many of the critics are. But nonetheless, I think the overall impression is of ambivalence, uncertainty, and sitting on the sidelines and allowing those regions to unravel. I don't know if there really was much that the United States could have done differently, but that certainly is the reality as I see it unfolding over the last several years.
Why is the region unraveling?
Well, that, of course, is a very difficult and complicated question. I would say there's just a host of issues that have been allowed to fester for decades. And in an atmosphere of economic stagnation, political authoritarianism, and widespread frustration on the part of masses of people, and you know, added to that and exacerbating it, a long, long tradition of foreign intervention, primarily from the West. And so I think it's just been so many intractable issues all kind of layered one on the other, with so many different actors intervening, very few of them with clean hands. It's difficult to point to any one of those factors as being the main one, but I think the fact that they have all occurred more or less simultaneously has put that whole region in an impossible situation.
Let's speak about some of those interventions that were destabilizing and led to the present impasse and authoritarian governments that are clinging to power.
Yes.
What are some of the interventions that you've studied that you find particularly that you find particularly difficult, or at least left a legacy of harm?
Well, I mean, this is not something I've studied closely. It's a more recent one, but certainly I would say the Iraq War of the early 2000s has very substantially destabilized the region and created a situation in which, you know, U.S. relations with Iran became more troubled, and of course, rise of ISIS was permitted to occur. So that would be a more recent intervention that definitely has destabilized the region substantially. Similarly, you could argue that the first Gulf War, by kind of starting us down the road of a long-term confrontation between the United States and Iraq, and of course the sanctions regime that was imposed on Iraq in the period between the first and second Gulf Wars, it was very damaging to Iraq itself, but it also had a distorting effect on the politics of the region. It was certainly a factor in the emergence of al-Qaeda in the 1990s as a potent force in the region. The fact that Osama bin Laden was able to point to the sanctions against Iraq, along with a number of other issues that were generating lots of unhappiness and resentment throughout the Arab and Muslim world, certainly was a factor in the emergence of al-Qaeda as a major force in that period.
But if the United States had not intervened, let me play devil's advocate here for a minute, in 1990, Saddam would have taken Kuwait and kept it. And that would have presented, of course, a big problem for Saudi Arabia down the road. Because once he had acquired Kuwait, many people suspected he might move on to Saudi Arabia and just lock up the entire Persian Gulf and would have gotten a taste for conquest and unifying the Arab world, as he said it should be. There are reasons to believe he might have gone on. To what extent should the United States just step aside and allow Middle Easterners to sort out their own problems and allow the stronger Middle Eastern states to dominate and to perhaps suck up some of these smaller states that are, you know, been propped up by the West? Kuwait is a creation of Great Britain, and maybe they should just disappear.
Okay, well, that's a very provocative state.
Well, but you said that America shouldn't have stepped in 1990.
Well, I wasn't necessarily saying the United States should not have stepped in. I'm saying these were the consequences of the fact that the United States did step in the manner in which it did. So I would not, and let's just take the case of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in 1990. I certainly would not take the position that the United States or the international community in general should have just sat back and done nothing and said, you know, that's the Middle East. They need to sort out their own problems. We have no say in what goes on. We have nothing to contribute to this, to resolving this issue. I think, you know, in the modern era, that's just not a realistic or morally defensible position to take. The international community has to concern itself with conflict wherever it occurs and bring to bear whatever inducements and pressures can realistically result in the resolution of those conflicts. It's a question of how you do it. The position that you are channeling may be correct, that ultimately there was no alternative to some use of force against Iraq in 1991 to ensure that Iraq withdrew from Kuwait. But I do think there were diplomatic alternatives that could have been explored a lot more vigorously than were explored. So, as you recall, Saddam Hussein did make this offer that he would look into withdrawing from Kuwait if Israel's occupation of the territories seized in 1967 came to an end. Certainly, there are all kinds of ways in which you could argue that there isn't really that much similarity between the two situations. Nonetheless, when we're talking about 1990, this was an occupation that had gone on for over 20 years. And it was definitely something that needed to be addressed. I think there could have been a more vigorous effort to try to link those two situations. It's possible that, you know, with a more vigorous attempt by the international community, led by the United States, to address the occupation of territories seized in 1967, which is something that should have been done anyway, regardless of what was taking place in Kuwait, conceivably there might have been greater willingness on the part of Iraq to come to accede to some face-saving exit from Kuwait. I think that that possibility could have been explored.
Let's shift to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Mm-hmm. And you've brought up this tantalizing question of the possibilities after 1990. The United States stepped in forcefully. George Bush, the father, put together a coalition of Arab states, with almost all the Arab states working together to contain Saddam Hussein and to get him out of Kuwait. This was a golden moment that George Bush himself saw and Baker saw, and they pushed for the Oslo. They pushed for some kind of peace agreement. Clinton inherited that,
right,
and pushed forward the Oslo Accords with a two-state solution idea,
mm-hmm,
not sticking fast to the 1967 borders of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, Gaza, that Israel had conquered, but saying that Resolution 242, the UN resolution after the 67 war that stated land for peace, had to be the basis for these negotiations.
Yes.
Now, today, that Oslo Accord seems completely moribund, and even the two-state solution seems rather moribund.
Sure.
Very hard to revive it at this point. Over 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. What could have been done in 1990? What should have been done to push that through to a conclusion that would have given the Palestinians a state?
Well, I mean, I do think that the first President Bush did make a good start. In the aftermath of the Gulf War, he did work with the Soviet Union, which of course was about to disappear, to convene the Madrid meeting in the fall of 1991, which did ultimately lead to Oslo. I mean, one of the most promising features of Oslo was, of course, the fact that finally you had direct negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. This was something that, you know, had been impossible for the previous quarter century. And certainly there was talk of land for peace. The Israelis didn't completely endorse it, but under U.S. prodding, it moved closer to accepting the notion of a Palestinian state. And so just the very idea of establishing an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza, which was something that the Palestinians and the Arab states and much of the international community had demanded for decades, but that the United States and Israel had resisted, finally the United States and Israel were coming around to that idea. And so that in itself was a major psychological breakthrough and created all kinds of opportunities for resolving the issue. What happened, unfortunately, was that the manner in which the negotiations unfolded from 93 on really helped to subvert the whole process of reaching an equitable settlement.
Manner?
Well, the problem was that there really wasn't ultimately a meeting of the minds over what the ultimate outcome should be. There really was not a mutual understanding over how much territory Israel should withdraw from and what the disposition of a number of issues such as Jerusalem, refugees, and so forth would be. What instead happened was that you began this protracted series of negotiations, the end result of which remained to be determined. And while those negotiations were taking place, Israel continued to expand the settler population and continued to take other measures that precluded the possibility of a genuinely independent Palestinian state from emerging in the future.
Do you think that Clinton could have moved more forcefully to pressure Israel to clarify those borders and to accept a Palestinian state that would be independent on its borders in the West Bank?
Yes, I do. I think the Clinton administration failed to make it clearer what the final outcome should be, and it failed to put pressure on Israel to cease the settlement activity. I mean, there were things that the Palestinians did too that were detrimental, and they were rightfully criticized for that. But the ability of the Israelis to continue settling the territory and taking other actions that undermined the possibility of a Palestinian state, I think was fatal.
So, Salim, what's going to happen to the Palestinians today?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. All I can say is that it doesn't look very promising right now, at least if we're talking about the immediate and maybe middle term, the next 10, 15 years. The United States clearly is not in a position to bring the parties to any serious negotiation. And I would say, frankly, it's out of a failure of the United States to grapple with the fact of the occupation and what it has done to the Palestinian territories, and its failure to grapple with the impact of settler activity in settler expansion in the occupied territories.
Well, certainly settler expansion seems to be going ahead at full force.
Absolutely.
In West Bank, there are over 2.5 million Palestinians there that are increasingly being pushed aside for these Israeli settlements. 1.5 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip that live in very dire circumstances. This situation, the status quo, as it's called in Israel, just goes on and on. And that means more loss of land, more settlers, Palestinians being marginalized. Will Palestinians be complacent? Will there be an attempt to uprising? And if there is, will Israel push them aside in some way?
Well, certainly that's a possibility. We've had this pattern for the last 15 years or so of kind of episodic eruptions of violence, largely focused on Gaza, but certainly it's been in the West Bank as well. Acts of violence, you know, Palestinian resistance, Israeli, massive Israeli retaliation, resulting in, major humanitarian crises and, sometimes flurries of diplomatic activity that usually end up in some kind of a ceasefire, but a continuation of the status quo, which is the acceleration of Israel's appropriation.
And how much does America's inability to solve this Arab-Israeli conflict limit U.S. ability to fix problems elsewhere in the Middle East, whether it's in Iraq or Syria or between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Well, I mean, a few years ago, I would have placed more emphasis on that, on the lack, loss of credibility that the United States has suffered because of its inability to grapple with the Israel-Palestine issue. I actually don't see it as quite as much of an issue on that front today as I would have seen a few years ago. I mean, I think what's taking place, and in some ways this is very discouraging, is that there is a greater willingness on the part of other actors in the Arab world to wash their hands of the Palestine issue and to essentially let it slide and not concern themselves with it, not allow it to interfere with other issues that they have concerns about. And certainly the Syrian civil war, the concern that many Arab countries have about Iran's rising profile in the region, I tend to think that those have trumped, so to speak, concern about the Palestine issue. So I don't think that the failure of the United States to resolve the Israel-Palestine issue is in itself having much of an inhibiting factor on its ability to address the other issues in the region. I mean, there are other factors that are inhibiting it, but I don't think it's the Palestine issue that's doing that right now.
Well, Salim Yacoub, it's been a delight talking with you. We've just gotten in some very interesting territory here, but we have to bring this to an end. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
That's Joshua Landis speaking with University of California Santa Barbara historian Salim Yacoub. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.